Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. And the last, if you listen to podcast 11, I don't know if you listened to these in order or not. If you listened to podcast number 11, you know that I started that one off with a little bit of scat singing of my intro, and I was playing that back this morning. I just checked these out before I go public with them, and my boy Timothy heard some of that, and he said, "Dad, is that one where you're just goofing around, just practicing?" And I said, "Oh no, you know, this is one I'm going to be putting up on the website." He said, "He says, Dad, I wouldn't do that. People are going to think you're crazy." So he says, "I wouldn't say it the way you did." Timothy's a nice, sensible young boy. I think he takes after his mother. His brother Robert's the one that's going to have all the trouble in life. His brother Robert was the one that was appropriately named. Anyway, we're gonna settle down and get down to business on this one and keep this one serious like an investing podcast should be. This is the 12th podcast that I've recorded. I'm recording it in September of 2008. And the title of this one is Market Timing, What Works and What Doesn't. The subject of this podcast is the subject on which there is more confusion, more misleading statements, more bad advice, more flat-out wrong statements than there is on any other investing topic that I can think of. It's sad and it's amazing. Something you'll often hear me do when I talk about these investing topics is a lot of them have this negative side to them, and I try not to get bogged down in that. I try to highlight a positive side, and there's a positive side to all the confusion about market timing. So maybe we should start with that. There is I don't know, we could call it a myth. There's a myth today that timing the market does not work. It's more than a myth. I don't know what to call it. It's a mass delusion. I don't know. If you ask the average investor today, is it possible to time the market? There are, of course, some people who try to time the market, but the vast majority of people today will say market timing is impossible, or market timing doesn't work, or market timing is a bad idea. And certainly that's true of the big name experts. And it is false. It is false. This isn't a matter of opinion. We have historical stock return data going back to 1870. We can check this. We can check whether market timing works or whether market timing does not work. And we've done this in the discussions we've had in the retire early and indexing discussion board communities. And we found that market timing has always worked. And if you think about it a bit, you will come to see, market timing must work. It's not even possible for the rational human mind to think of a scenario in which market timing would not work. Now, obviously, you can go about it the wrong way. There are right ways to go about market timing, and there are wrong ways to go about market timing. And if you go about it the wrong way, it's going to give poor results, certainly. That's true of anything. You know, it's possible in driving a car to drive off a cliff, and you're going to have bad results, but that doesn't mean that car driving never works. It just means there are certain rules that have to be followed. So the purpose of this podcast is to point out some of the things that work and some of the things that don't work. And this is the elementary course. We could go into that, the question of what works and what doesn't, on a much deeper level than I will here today. But and there are still many things we have to learn. We don't know all the things that work and all the things that don't work. But we do know the basics. And that's the purpose of this podcast, to go over the basics of what works and what doesn't. But let me just start by putting this in some historical perspective and noting how we are at a time and a point in our understanding of how investing works that is, from one perspective, very discouraging. It's very frustrating to look at all the information we have available to us today and how much more effectively we could be investing if only more of us were aware of this information. That's a very frustrating reality. But the other side of that coin, the exciting part of it is, if only we could get this information out to people, how much good we could do. We could turn around, change the course of investing history, because this is very important, very powerful stuff. It's not just that market timing can work. And I know that that's how a lot of people are going to approach this podcast. A lot of people are not going to even listen to it. They're going to see the title and they're going to say, market timing's not for me, or if I were going to engage in market timing, it would take a lot of work and I just don't want to put the time and effort into it. It doesn't take much time and work, and the benefits of market timing are huge. So the way I would state it is, not only can market timing work, I would say any investor who hopes to be a successful long-term investor must engage in market timing. You must. And but let me get back again to that positive point I wanted to make. What's happened is we have learned new things about how to invest over the past, let's say, the past 40 years. And there was a day when a lot of people used to think short-term market timing worked. Short-term market timing is what the media is all worked up about in all the articles they put out. Every day they follow the price changes and they make it sound like, oh, this happened, that happened, and everybody's trying to guess. They quote all these people. You know, I think it's going up, I think it's going down, and that stuff is just nowheresville, as far as I'm concerned. It may be that there are some super smart people who can time the market successfully in the short term, who can guess which way it's going to go. I'm not recording these podcasts for those people. Those people have other sources of information. That's at most 5% of the population, at most. I'm recording this for the average middle-class investor. For the average middle-class investor, short-term timing does not work. If you read the newspaper, it says stock prices are going down, it makes you feel depressed, you think, I'm going to get out. If you're getting out based on what you read in the newspapers and how it made you depressed, you're probably doing exactly the wrong thing, because the newspapers aren't going to write the story in such a way as to make you depressed until prices have already fallen so low that the future looks good. That's the way it works. And if you try to do it, some people will try to outsmart that. So when it goes down, they'll try to do the opposite of what they emotionally feel they should do. And they'll get it wrong too, because there's just too many aspects to the question. None of us can sort out what's going to happen in the short term. So the positive thing is that we have learned this. It is now, when you get this slogan rammed through your brain 10,000 times. Timing doesn't work. Timing doesn't work. Timing doesn't work. What's happened is that message has taken hold. And there are many people today who believe that. Timing doesn't work. And there's a good side to that. Because if only they changed it to say, short-term timing doesn't work. Short-term timing doesn't work. Short-term timing doesn't work. Then it would be a legitimate message. Then we would be learning something important. We would be moving ahead. But the problem, what makes this a sad and frustrating topic, is that the experts who have been telling us the timing doesn't work have failed to make the distinction between short-term timing and long-term timing. Short-term timing truly does not work. Long-term timing always works if you do it properly. And long-term timing is essential to long-term success as an investor. So that distinction is the most important distinction there is in the field of investing. What's the difference? What's the difference between short-term timing and long-term timing? Short-term timing is you make a change in your stock allocation with the thought that you are going to see a benefit from doing so in the next 3 months or the next 6 months or the next year or the next 2 years. You are not going far out into the future. There's a reason why that does not work. The reason why short-term timing does not work is that in the short term, there are different factors that affect stock prices. In the short term, the most important factor is investor emotions. And investor emotions are almost entirely unpredictable. No one knows. Now, people who engage in technical analysis, they claim to be able to look at certain trends and know which way investor emotions are going. I have not studied technical analysis in enough depth to know for sure whether these people can do this or not. I personally am skeptical, but if you're a technical analyst and if you believe it works, more power to you. I would love to learn more about how that could work, but as of today, I have to say what I believe today, and as of today, I don't believe. I believe technical analysis may have some value, but I don't believe it can be used to practice short-term timing effectively in a reliable way. I especially don't think that's going to work for the average middle-class investor. If it does work at all, it would work for someone who was able to put a lot of time and effort into studying those charts. And the middle-class investors that I am recording these podcasts for are not the type of people who would be doing that. So for those investors, short-term timing is not the way to go. Long-term timing is making a change in your stock allocation with the thought of benefiting from it in the long term. 3 years down the road, or 5 years down the road, or 10 years down the road, or 15 years down the road. That's long-term timing. And long-term timing always works. That's an incredible claim, but it stands up to scrutiny. Please don't take my word for it. Take a look at the historical stock return data. If you go to my website, passionsaving.com, I have links there to the historical stock return data. You can study it. You can go year by year. And you can look at 1 year. Pick any year you want. And just say, okay, here's what stock valuations were. Here's the direction in which stocks should be headed in the long term. And now, let me look 10 years out and see what happened. And you will see that stock returns, the price level of the overall market is to a large extent predictable. It's not entirely predictable. So if you're going to go into it with the attitude of, I need to be able to predict exactly what the S&P level is going to be 10 years from now, you're not going to be able to do it. That's not possible. But you don't need to be able to do that to be able to time the market successfully. All you need to do to time the market successfully is to have a good sense of where things are going in the long term. And that you absolutely can do. Now, when I make the statement that long-term timing always works, I need to throw in a caveat so that you know what I'm saying. There's a calculator at my website. It's called the Investors Scenario Surfer. And what you do with this calculator is you put in a stock allocation for the first year, and then you press enter, and the calculator, using a random number generator, tells you what but a random number generator that also has filters based on how stocks have always performed in the past. So the numbers are not entirely random. They're partly random, and they're partly the result of our historical experience with stock returns. The calculator will then tell you how your investment did for that year. And of course, the valuation level will change as a result. And then you can either pick the same allocation for the second year, or you can change it. And you run through a 30-year sequence. And at the end of 30 years, you see whether you picked your stock allocation effectively or not. And you can compare. If you use long-term timing as your strategy, as I recommend, you can then compare. The calculator allows you to compare the results you obtained with the results you would have obtained if instead you had been rebalancing. Rebalancing would be to stay at the same stock allocation every year. And when I practice long-term timing with that calculator, I do better than rebalancing probably in close to 90% of the test. So that's why I say long-term timing always works. Now, that of course suggests when I say that I do better than rebalancing in 90% of the test, that suggests that in 10% rebalancing does better, and that's true. You occasionally will have scenarios where rebalancing will do better than long-term timing. But even in those cases, I would argue long-term timing succeeds, because if you look at the actual results, what you will find is that long-term timing frequently beats rebalancing by a large amount at the end of 30 years. The benefit is often huge. It's not true the other way around. With rebalancing, when rebalancing beats long-term timing, it usually is by a small amount of money. And what's really going on there is not that rebalancing is a superior strategy. It's just the luck of the draw. You're picking a high-risk strategy. When you go with rebalancing, you're going with a strategy that is unlikely to pay off in the long term, but which every now and then comes through because of some fluke random occurrence. So what you're getting with rebalancing is you sometimes, maybe 1 out of 10 cases, will get a better result, but really because of luck. So what's happened is you're taking on more risk, and you're getting small compensation for that risk. You're not getting much in the way of added return for the additional risk you're taking on. So even in the cases in which long-term timing doesn't win in dollar terms, on a risk-adjusted basis, it does. Long-term timing is the intelligent way to invest, the rational way to invest, the emotionally healthy way to invest. And even if in 1 out of 10 cases you don't end up ahead in dollar terms, you will know that throughout that 30-year time, you would have more confidence in your decisions because you're making your decisions from a rational standpoint. So you're still ahead. And frankly, the truth of the matter is those who try to engage in rebalancing are rarely going to be able to stick with it. There are many people who have stuck with rebalancing through the huge bull market, but it's getting harder and harder as prices continue to drop. And when prices drop hard, which is what we should be expecting, given how stocks have always performed from these valuation levels in the past, when prices drop hard, I doubt very much that there are going to be many rebalancers or people who call themselves buy and holders who are going to be able to stick with those high stock allocations. They're going to be selling. And so even the cases in which rebalancing appears to be ahead at the end of 30 years, that 1 out of 10 case, even in those cases, in the real world, they probably would not have been ahead. People following those strategies would have abandoned them because they cannot have confidence in them. They cannot have confidence in them because rebalancing is a rejection of long-term timing. rebalancing does not make sense. It does not make sense. That's a strong claim, but I think it's a true claim. Why do I say it doesn't make sense? You have to think about, what is long-term timing? What does it mean to engage in long-term timing? All that it is being price conscious. The valuation level, let's assume that you're investing in an index. Most of the advice that I offer at my website is based on an indexing, valuation-informed indexing strategy. So say you are buying the S&P index. That's how you're investing. If you don't look, if you're not going to change your allocation, regardless of the price that stocks are selling at, well, there's no sense in looking at the price, is there? If you decide up front you're going to do what they call buy and hold, the conventional approach to buy and hold, which is just to pick a stock allocation and stay at it no matter what, there's no sense in even paying attention to the price at which stocks are being sold. And that's what a lot of people are doing today. Millions of middle-class investors today are paying no attention to price because they've bought into the conventional buy and hold approach. And once you buy into that, price doesn't matter. Now think about this. Is there any other asset that you buy where you don't ask what the price is before you put money down? Would you buy a car without considering the price? Would you buy a house without considering the price? Would you buy a banana without considering the price? You wouldn't. You wouldn't. And this is the only area I know where people do this, where large numbers of people are willing to not look at price. The only area is stock investing. And what a terrible choice. More of your money is going to go into stocks than go into any of these other product categories. You're going to end up over the course of a lifetime putting more money into stocks than you put into cars, or more than you put into bananas, or more than you put into comic books. In most cases, you're going to put more into stocks than you put into houses. So all of the price consciousness that you're employing when you make all these other purchases is being counterbalanced by your failure to consider prices when you buy stocks. That does not make sense. The value proposition of stocks is very strong. There's no one who is more pro-stock than I am. I think investing in stocks is the key to achieving financial freedom early in life. So stocks offer a wonderful long-term value proposition. Please don't get me wrong. But that doesn't mean that stocks are a good deal at any price. Stocks are a wonderful, amazing deal at some prices. Stocks are a strong deal at some prices. Stocks are an okay deal at some prices. And stocks are a bad deal at some prices. And stocks are an awful, frightening deal at some prices. You have to know the price. And again, I'm not talking about short-term timing. I'm not telling you that I can tell you what the price of the S&P is going to be a year from now. I can't. But if you ask me what it's going to be 10 years from now, I can give you a pretty good idea. I can tell you the range of possibilities in 10 years, and I can assign probabilities to various points along the spectrum. That I can do. And I can do that by looking at the historical stock return data. Go 20 years out, and I can do an even better job. There are statistical tools that can be used to find out how predictable something is. And we've used those statistical tools on the historical stock return data, trying to find out how much we can determine about how stocks are going to do in the future by looking at the valuation level that applies today. If you go out 20 years, stock prices are 78% predictable. Only 22% is a random variation, something that you can't anticipate. They're 78% predictable. Stocks are a far safer asset class than most people realize. People think that, many, many people think that stock prices are entirely unpredictable. And if that were so, stocks would be a far less appealing asset class than they truly are. one of the things that makes stocks so appealing is that they give fantastic returns, but combined with a high level, a reasonably high level of predictability. To say that the predictability is high is going too far. But stocks are, we can have a reasonable degree of confidence in long-term predictions on stocks. So I absolutely believe that long-term timing is possible, but I go much farther than that. I say that long-term timing is mandatory if you want to be a successful long-term investor. Because what happens is, we're seeing this today, there are millions of people who have bought into the passive investing concept. With passive investing, you never change your stock allocation. What's happening to these people today is we've now had 9 years where stocks have performed poorly, and these people are starting to panic. And if you go on discussion boards, you can see it. You can see the way people are talking. They're trying to hold on, but they're getting more and more anxious each year that passes. And they've got a lot of bad times ahead, considering how high prices are today. We are now at one of the highest price levels ever seen in the history of the U.S. stock market. So there are a lot of bad times for stocks ahead. These people are going to end up selling. And none of this is necessary. If these people had been informed about how poor a value proposition stocks offer at the sort of price levels that they were at in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, these people would have been prepared. They would have lowered their stock allocations appropriately when prices got out of control, and they would now be thinking about starting to increase them a little bit. You know, if you've been going with a 30% stock allocation for the past 10 years, you're now at a point where maybe you stay at 30 a little longer, but as prices continue to drop, you might increase your allocation to 40% or 50%. It's a very different ballgame for those who have been sticking with a 70% or an 80% stock allocation for the last 10 years. Those people are being put through the ringer, an emotional ringer. And they're not going to be able to hold on. And the key to practicing buy and hold successfully is being aware of the effect of prices on long-term returns and changing your allocation. You can't just be aware. You can't just know that valuations affect long-term returns. You have to do something about it. There are so many experts out there today who will acknowledge valuations affect long-term returns. If you ask them that question, they'll say yes. And then you'll say, well, how much do you recommend people change their stock allocations? They'll say, oh, there's no need to change your stock allocation. Well, the two ideas are in conflict. If valuations affect long-term returns, then you must change your stock allocation when prices get out of control. Because that's the only way in the real world, in the practical flesh and blood world, to take advantage of what you know about the effect of valuations on long-term returns. I want to tell a story, a short story, about the confusion on this point between short-term timing and long-term timing. There's a guy, I used to post at a discussion board, the Vanguard Diehards board. And there's a guy there, Taylor Larimore. He's the co-author of a book entitled The Boglehead's Guide to Investing. And every now and then he would put up a post where he would talk about timing. And he'd have a list of experts. And I don't know, he'd have 15 people on this list. And he'd have 15 quotes where they say something derogatory about timing. You know, timing doesn't work. I've never known anybody to succeed at timing. Everybody thinks timing's good, but it's not, you know, on and on and on and on. And I would respond to this post when he would put it up, and I'd say, Taylor, all of those comments were comments on short-term timing. And I agree that short-term timing doesn't work. What do you think about long-term timing? Because long-term timing does work. The same historical data that shows that short-term timing doesn't work shows that long-term timing does work. And he would come back, and his next post would be not 15 experts, he'd have 30. And they would say, timing is bad, timing doesn't work, don't time, whatever you do. And I'd say, Taylor, okay, I understand. Short-term timing doesn't work. First you showed 15 quotes and now you've got 30. How about long-term timing? The same historical data that shows that short-term timing doesn't work shows that long-term timing does work. What do you think about helping people to understand how to engage in long-term timing? And Taylor would come back, and this time he'd have 60, you know, 60 quotes. And, you know, I'd give the same response, and he'd come back with, you know, 128. And it would go on and on like that. You can get as many quotes as you want. Name the number. You can find them on the internet of experts who will tell you that short-term timing doesn't work, because there's a lot of evidence it doesn't work. But I have never found any evidence that long-term timing does not work. Never. And I've studied this in depth for 6 years. If you know of any evidence that long-term timing doesn't work, please bring it to my attention. That's something I need to know about. That's something I need to let my listeners and my readers know about. I don't think it exists. I've looked at the historical data. Now, of course, if you engage in long-term timing in crazy ways, you know, you can turn anything bad if you engage it in crazy ways. John Walter Russell has a phrase, idiot switching. You know, these people will come up with some method where they'll say, go to 100% stocks when the valuation is X and go to 0% stocks when the valuation level is Y. And surprise, surprise, that won't work. Well, of course. Because there is no valuation level where when prices go up just a little bit, it's going to change the long-term value proposition enough to justify going from a zero allocation to 100% allocation. So if you engage in long-term timing in crazy nitwit ways, you're going to get bad results, of course. But anyone who engages in long-term timing in a reasoned way, it's hard to see how it would not work. I made the statement earlier. I said the human mind cannot imagine how long-term timing could not work. Is that really so? It is. If you think about it on a risk-adjusted basis. Because what's happening when prices are higher is the risk of a price drop is greater, obviously. When prices go to the moon, the chances of prices taking a big tumble are much higher than they are when prices are low or moderate. So the risk is obviously higher when we're at high prices. And the historical data shows us that the long-term return is far higher, far, far higher when we are at low prices or moderate prices than it is when we're at the sort of prices that apply today. So you're always taking on more risk at high prices, and you're always obtaining a smaller return. The phrase I use to sum that up is long-term value proposition. The long-term value proposition is simply less when prices are high. So when you set your stock allocation, what you're trying to do is to determine what stock allocation is right for you. How much risk do you want to take on? And there is no one answer. I can't say everyone should have a 50% stock allocation or everyone should have an 80% stock allocation. There is no one answer. We're all in different financial circumstances. But what I can say with absolute certainty is if an 80% stock allocation is right for you at a time of moderate prices, an 80% stock allocation cannot possibly be right for you at the sort of prices that apply today, at high prices, because the long-term value proposition is so different. So what you want to do as an investor is to have your allocation. That's the primary thing that you can influence as an investor. You can use your mind to pick the best stock allocation. You're not going to get it perfect. None of us do. But you should be aiming to have your allocation as close to the mark as you can get it. If you don't change your allocation when the long-term value proposition changes dramatically, you're not even trying. You're giving up before the game begins. That's passive investing. Passive investing is blind investing. Passive investing is giving up before you start. Passive investing is emotional investing. It's saying, I don't want to know. I don't want to know how stocks work. I want to put blinders on. This is the thing, that I preach against. If you want to achieve financial freedom early in life, you need to care about your money. You need to care about how much money you have. And that should be your driver. That's the thing you should use to motivate you to save. And that's what I talk about, you know, all throughout my first book, Passion Saving, that it's your desire for financial freedom that is the engine of your financial plan. It's the motivation you get because of those goals you want to achieve that help you to save money, not some gimmicky trick. You know, people come up with all these rules of thumb and all this sort of thing, and I don't think they work. What works is caring about that goal, making it part of your life plan to achieve certain financial goals. Well, the same thing happens with investing. If you care about achieving your financial goals, you're going to care enough to take the little bit of time it takes to understand that the long-term value proposition changes when prices go from low to moderate to high to out of control, and that your allocation has to change with it. The comparison I would make is to gambling at a slot machine. A lot of people can't understand. They say, you recommend long-term timing. You say short-term timing can't work, but yet you recommend long-term timing. They say that doesn't make sense. It should be easy to predict the short-term. You know, it should be easy to predict what's going to happen a year out. How can you know what's going to happen 10 years out if you can't know what's going to happen a year out? Well, it's a question of getting the probabilities on your side. Think about a slot machine. We all know that if a gambler sits at a slot machine and plays it for 10 hours, who's going to end up ahead? The casino's going to end up ahead because the odds are slanted in favor of the casino. It's a rare gambler who can sit at a slot machine for 10 hours and end up ahead. 90% of the time, the house is going to be on top. Now, that's not really true if you only sit at the slot machine for 5 minutes. There are a lot of people who sit at a slot machine for 5 minutes and end up ahead. And the reason is the odds are still against them. But 10 pulls of a slot machine doesn't really give enough time for the odds to kick in and have that much power. So you can beat the odds. You can beat the odds once or twice or three times. And the same thing's true with stock investing. So stocks offered a very poor value proposition in 1997. Valuation levels were through the roof. But stocks did very well in 1997. The gamblers won their bet. Same thing was true in 1998. And the same thing was true in 1999. It stopped working in 2000, and it hasn't worked since. And if you go back to, if you went out of stocks and you put your money smartly into super safe asset classes like TIPS or I-bonds back in 1998, you'd be ahead of the game today. I took my money out of stocks in 1996, and I'm ahead of the game today. I wouldn't be ahead. I'm not ahead on the money just from 1996 or 1997, but there was additional money that I put into savings in 98 and 99, and because I'm ahead on that money, which is larger than the amount I'm behind on in 96 and 97, on an overall basis, I'm ahead today. Now, John Bogle, he has a statement he makes. He says, not only do I not know anyone who has timed the market successfully, I don't know anyone who knows anyone who has timed the market successfully. Well, that statement is false because John Bogle knows Mel Lindauer. Mel Lindauer is another co-author of The Boglehead's Guide to Investing. And I post it with Mel Lindauer on the Vanguard Diehards board. And I know that John Bogle knows him. Mel Lindauer calls John Bogle his mentor. So I know that he knows him. He meets him. There's an annual meeting that the diehards have. And Bogle stands on the stage with Mel Lindauer. He shakes his hand. They talk. They sit at lunch and they talk. So he knows them. And Mel Lindauer knows Rob Bennett. Mel Lindauer, he waged a vicious smear campaign to get me removed from that board because he didn't want people hearing how long-term timing works. So Mel Lindauer knows Rob Bennett, and Mel Lindauer knows the story of how I got out of stocks in 96 and how I'm ahead of the game today financially as a result of doing so. So John Bogle does know someone who knows someone who has timed the market successfully. And I'm only a little bit ahead today, but think what's going to happen after the big price drop. I'm going to be much farther ahead. And then there's going to be compounding benefits that are going to stretch years into the future, and I'll be farther and farther and farther ahead. If you want to get a sense of how that works, please go to the website, look at the scenario surfer, enter in some numbers of your own. There's no better way to learn about what works with market timing than to use that calculator, because it allows you to test your reactions to all sorts of investing scenarios. And what you will see is the market performs in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes it goes straight up and then straight down. Other times it plateaus for a long period of time. Other times there are little jumps up and down, up and down. In all those scenarios, if you engage in intelligent long-term timing, you end up ahead at the end of 30 years. I believe that it appears to me from what I've seen with the calculator that the average middle-class worker could retire 5 years sooner if he practiced long-term timing than if he fails to do so. That's how big a difference this makes. So I strongly urge you to learn about long-term timing and to practice it. And of course, what you have to learn is what works and what doesn't. So I want to quickly wrap this up. I want to quickly run through some of the points I made in an article on the website with the same title as this podcast, Market Timing, What Works and What Doesn't. You certainly do not want to engage in short-term timing. You certainly do want to engage in long-term timing. You do not want to go all in and all out. A lot of people, when you tell them long-term timing works, they react defensively, and they jump to this idea. They adopt this cartoon version of timing. You're either the valuation level is good and you're 100% in stocks, or the valuation level is bad and you have zero in stocks. That makes no sense. Because what's happening with stocks is that the probabilities are changing over time. I give you my example from 1997 again. The probabilities in 97 were poor. Stock investing was a bad bet. But if you had gone to zero stocks, you would have hurt yourself, because stocks went up dramatically in 97, 98, and 99. So it was much better to have gone with something like a 30% stock allocation. And that way, you get the benefits if stocks go up, if stocks beat the odds. But you're protected in the more likely scenario that stocks go down dramatically. Now, I got all out of stocks, but that was because of my personal financial circumstances that because of the plan I was putting together, I couldn't afford to take the sort of hit that I stood a good chance of taking if I had my money in stocks. So each person has to consider their personal circumstances. But as a general rule, I don't think it's at all a good idea to ever go to a zero stock allocation or to ever go to 100% stock allocation. You always should be hedging your bets a little bit, because we don't know how stocks are going to do in the short term. We just do not know. And no matter how low prices get, they can get still lower. No matter how high prices get, they can get still higher. And we certainly saw that in the 1990s. The highest PE 10 level, that's the valuation assessment tool I use, the highest PE 10 level we had ever reached was in 1929. We had gone to a PE 10 level of 33. That was the highest level ever. So when we got to 33, anyone with knowledge of the history of the market would have been tempted to get totally out of stocks. But in the late 1990s, we went way beyond 33. We went all the way up to a PE 10 level of 44. So just because we are at very high valuation levels does not mean that it's a good move to go to zero stocks. I would generally recommend a strategy that was recommended by Benjamin Graham a long, long time ago in his book Security Analysis, where he recommends changing your allocation roughly from 75% at times of low valuations to 50% at times of moderate valuations to 25% at times of high valuations. I think that generally makes sense. I would probably tilt it a little higher than that. I might go with, at times of moderate valuations, I might go with 60 or 70% stocks. Times of really low valuations, I might go up as high as 90% stocks. So I might tend to tilt it a bit because I have a bit of a pro-stock bias. But I think the concept that Benjamin Graham put forward was a very good one. The concept of not being all in or all out, of making gradual, modest changes in your stock allocation, but certainly not going with passive investing, certainly not choosing one stock allocation and sticking with it no matter what. That way lies doom. It's a mistake to make frequent changes in your stock allocation. One reason is because there are costs associated with making frequent changes. There's no need for incurring those transaction costs. Another reason is it's just not a good idea. If you're changing your stock allocation every year or two or three, there's something wrong. That's an indication that you're just too emotional and you need to sort of settle down, maybe get out of stocks for a little bit, learn the basics. There's just no need. Now, obviously, if prices change dramatically in 2 years, you have to change your stock allocation. But small changes in price don't justify changes in allocation. A PE10 level of 14 is normal. That's the fair price level for stocks. If we go from 14 to 16, that's not a dramatic change. Or if we go from 14 to 12, that's not a dramatic change. So you don't need to make allocation changes. You're putting too much weight on your finding about the price level if you're making changes every time we see little changes like that. But when we go from 14 to 20, yes, you better make a stock allocation change then. That's a dramatic change. The long-term value proposition has changed dramatically when that happens. I did a test in preparation for an article I was writing for the site, and I never had time to finish it. So I'll probably have to redo this test. But I did a test one time using the scenario surfer to try to find out how often I needed to make changes in my allocation to obtain the good results that are obtained with long-term timing. And I went through three 30-year sequences of returns. And on average, I was trying deliberately to make as few changes as possible while still making changes that absolutely had to be made. And in that test, I averaged one change in allocation every 14 years and still beat rebalancing all three times. I beat 80% rebalancing, 50% rebalancing, and 20% rebalancing. So you don't need to make frequent changes for this approach to work. If I wasn't trying to limit my changes, I would probably make a stock allocation every 7 or 8 years. I think that's probably the norm. 10 years, if you don't feel comfortable doing it in 7 or 8 years, one change every 10 years can certainly work. You don't need to make frequent changes. And if you are making changes too frequently, I consider that a bad sign. There's all sorts of ways to do it. And I keep an open mind to other strategies. And if people find that they can do more frequent changes and have that work, I'm interested in hearing what they have to say. But it rubs me a little bit the wrong way if you're making too many changes, because it suggests too much emotion. Every time you change your stock allocation, there's a bit of emotion involved. And so generally, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea to wait until there's a big drop in prices before lowering your allocation. I've seen people doing that in recent years. They will say, oh, I know the prices are too high. I sort of have a sense that I should be lowering my allocation, but I'm going to wait until I confirm that prices are going down. That's a dangerous business. Prices can drop rapidly. And when prices start to drop, you're going to get caught up in the emotion. You might lower your stock allocation too much. You might overdo it. It's better to make any allocations or changes you're going to make at a time when you can be calm and reasoned about it. Don't wait for dramatic price changes upward or downward to take place before making your allocation changes. It's not a good idea to hold off on buying stocks until stocks are lower than fair value levels. I mentioned that the fair value level for stocks is a PE 10 of 14. Well, stocks offer an amazing long-term value proposition at 14. So don't say, oh, I'm not going to buy any stocks until the PE 10 level is below 14. That's crazy. Stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition at a PE 10 of 15 or 16 or 17 or 18. So don't wait. Don't wait until we're below fair value. That's greed. And that'll hurt you in the long run. It's a good idea to put your long-term strategies in writing. Think through. Look at the historical data. Look at the calculators at the website. And think through, what sort of strategies am I going to be following? And then put them in writing. Because that divorces you a bit from the emotion of the moment. You want to avoid getting caught up in the emotion of the moment. So that's a good idea. Now, I don't follow that religiously myself. Some of the things I'll talk about on these podcasts are ideas that I'm pondering, where I don't really have a strategy worked out. I have strategies on a lot of these questions, but not on all of them, because we still have information coming in. And that point sort of ties into my final point, which is, while you should write your strategies down and to some extent try to limit yourself, try to lock yourself in, you also have to remain open to changing your mind. And this is a mistake I've seen with a lot of passive investors. What a lot of passive investors are doing today is they've adopted the passive investing model. They followed it for a number of years. It seemed to work for a number of years. Passive investing works great in a huge bull market. Huge bull markets are irrational, and passive investing is an irrational investing strategy, so they're tailor-made for each other. Once the huge bull market is over, passive investing performs very poorly. And so a lot of these people today, they're sort of questioning their allegiance to passive investing, but they feel that they're locked in. They say, oh, I have to be unemotional. I can't let my emotions change my plan. Well, none of us know everything when we start investing. So we have to go into this with an understanding that while we want to stick with our strategies for the long term, while that certainly is a good goal to have, we can't be fanatical about it. If you make a mistake, you have to acknowledge your mistake, and you have to make changes. Passive investing doesn't work. We now know that. The evidence is overwhelming. So we need to take what's good. If there are good things you've learned during the time you became a passive investor, well, stick to those. Maybe you learned that short-term timing doesn't work. Well, stick to that. Don't abandon that. Maybe you learned that you need to focus on the long term. Stick to that. Don't abandon that. Maybe you learned that stocks are your favorite asset class. Stick to that. Don't abandon that. But if you learned that you should never change your stock allocation, and the evidence is now overwhelming that that's a bad idea, abandon that idea. Or at the least, cut back on your allegiance to that idea. Maybe you can find a middle ground. Maybe you don't want to go strictly with what the historical data says, but you'll go somewhere between following the historical data, which says to change your allocation, and following passive investing, which says not to change it. Maybe instead of lowering your allocation from 70% to 30%, you lower it from 70 to 50%. Well, that's a big step in the right direction. But it's a good idea to try to write down your strategies, because that's a way of thinking them through, making your plan solid, and it's a way of avoiding some of the worst emotional pitfalls. But at the same time, and it's a bit paradoxical, human beings are paradoxical. That's the way it is. And investing is a human act. So we have to expect investing to be somewhat paradoxical. While you want to write things down and you, to some extent, you want to stick to your strategies, you have to maintain some flexibility because we don't know it all. Perhaps as you get older and more experienced and more confident, you'll be able to stick with your, you'll have more success sticking with your strategies. But nobody can know it all at the time they need to make their first investment. So none of us can afford to be excessively dogmatic. The website is passionsaving.com. Please send me feedback on what you've heard today. I'd love to hear from you. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.